supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Today, Philadelphia City Council and Mayor Jim Kenney agreed on a budget for fiscal year 2019. Budget packages for Pennsylvania and Delaware are progressing through each legislature, and at this juncture, they're on track to be wrapped up by week's end. But New Jersey's fiscal future is not so certain. A showdown between the state's Democratic lawmakers and Democratic Governor Phil Murphy may spur a repeat of last year's state shutdown. Joining me live on the line with an update is NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier. John, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Another busy day trying to resolve the issues. What's the status of the stalemate at this hour?
The latest is we just had a press conference with Governor Phil Murphy telling us that they've yet to strike a deal. There was some hope earlier today because Murphy had been holding a series of meetings with legislative leaders, but it looks like those meetings haven't resulted in a deal. In fact, he used some pretty strong words about his negotiating partners coming out. In New Jersey, we have a Democratic-controlled legislature and a Democratic governor, and one of his lines was, "I believe I'm fighting with Democrats," which seemed to be a reference to maybe they're acting more like, in his eyes, Republicans today.
I'm sure that does not please Senate President Steve Sweeney and State Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin. What are the major sticking points?
Yeah, about half an hour before that press conference, they were meeting in the governor's office, and both of the legislative leaders walked out stone-faced. So I would agree with you there. The big sticking point in this whole budget discussion is revenue. All sides seem to be in agreement on key things that they want to increase spending on: public employee pensions, K through 12 education, mass transit are the big ones. The big differences are, how do they get the money to pay for that increased spending? The governor wants a millionaire's tax in New Jersey, and he wants a higher sales tax. The legislative leaders want a higher corporate tax rate and a bunch of other smaller revenue measures that the governor has found fault with and portrayed as shaky and tough to do solid revenue projections off of. So that's pretty much where we sit right now. It's a tug of war over which tax to increase to cover spending that they all seem to agree on.
Easy for me to say, but is it either or can they meet in the middle?
Well, I think you're on to where, if this does get resolved, where that resolution would come out of. You would see some sort of compromise where maybe two of the three taxes that are on the table get increased, or maybe there's some phase-in or some tweaking. At some point in the negotiations, there have been some rumblings that they've started to talk about the framework that way. The governor denied that there were some reports today that he was considering maybe a five millionaire's tax instead of a one millionaire's tax, and he denied some of those reports. So it's unclear exactly where that type of negotiation stands, but it seems like if there is to be a compromise, it will be somewhere taking some combination of all the different proposals that are on the table right now.
This is Phil Murphy's first go-round, and what of the insinuations that he's speaking perhaps even beyond New Jersey lawmakers and voters, appealing instead to a national audience?
I don't know so much. I mean, I think for the Democratic Party right now, it's a key moment because New Jersey has tried for a long time, the New Jersey Democrats, to get back. Chris Christie was governor here for 8 years, to get back complete control of the state house. Now they finally have it. And in the context of what's going on nationally, Democrats would like to be able to juxtapose the way they operate with the way maybe, say, Washington's operating under Republican control. But what we're seeing in Trenton is similar to, you know, some of the dysfunction, I guess, that happens in Washington, where even though it's all the same party, you have different factions within the party that make it hard. I mean, New Jersey's been trying for years to pass a millionaire's tax. Governor Christie always vetoed it. Now there's a Democratic governor who supports a millionaire's tax, and yet they're not able to do it. So I think if Murphy's looking nationally, it's that he would like to show Democrats can do things responsibly, and he doesn't feel like at this point that he's got a dance partner in the legislature right now to do that for his party.
Last question, worst case scenario, what happens if we get to June 30th and beyond without a budget?
Well, we'll see different. So the state constitution prevents the Treasury from spending money without a budget in place. The fiscal year starts on July 1. They can do some things to preserve safety, health, and welfare. But you like we had last year, you'll see state parks shut down. Now, the one advantage this year is the shutdown would start over a weekend, so you wouldn't see the full force of it for a few days. But we'll be back for those who remember last year's shutdown. Bring back those memories, or I guess, because that's where we're looking at that possibility now.
So we likely won't see Governor Murphy on a public beach.
He's promised that that's not something he will do.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
And Jay Spotlight's John Reitmeier on Newsworks Tonight. President Donald Trump has stopped his administration's policy of separating immigrant parents from their children at the Mexican border. But the policy caused such a huge controversy that some political experts say it may have lasting effects impacting midterm elections in November. Details from WHYY's Joe Hernandez.
The lunch crowd is filing into the White Dot Dairy Bar in rural Southampton Township. I met Kara Tunney Deshane of Mount Laurel, who's getting ice cream with her daughter. We talked on Tuesday before Trump rescinded the family separation policy, and Tunney Deshane said she thought it was wrong.
I just know that I'm a mother of, two children, and if my child was taken from me, I don't know what I would do. I'd be so worried, and I know they would be scared, especially.
But she also believes that the government has to restrict the number of people who come into the U.S.
We do need to somehow, limit immigration, but I just don't know if Trump's going about it the right way sometimes.
Trump axed the family separation policy on Wednesday with an executive order. But political analysts are wondering how much the national controversy over the policy will affect voters like Tunney Deshane in the fall.
We're not sure how this is all going to play out.
Ben Dworkin is a professor of public policy at Rowan University.
What is clear is that this is another case in which it adds to a narrative that I believe the Democrats are certainly pushing as the Trump administration is extreme, uncaring, inhospitable to immigrants.
New Jersey's 3rd congressional district, which includes Southampton and Mount Laurel, may be a good test case. There, former Rhodes Scholar and Obama administration official Andy Kim is challenging incumbent Tom MacArthur. The two-term Republican has been a staunch supporter of President Trump. Although MacArthur called for Trump to unilaterally end the family separation policy, many voters still associate the former insurance executive with the president. That may not be a problem in much of the 3rd District, which leans Republican, but for voters like Tunney Deshane, the family separation controversy may creep back into their consciousness come Election Day.
If somebody else had the same opinion as Trump, I think I probably wouldn't vote for them.
Then again, a lot can change in 4 months. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Ridership on SEPTA buses has been declining over the past few years, and to win back commuters, the transit agency proposes a comprehensive redesign of its bus network. As Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, SEPTA's redesign effort will follow guidelines set by an influential transit thinker.
SEPTA has never before completely overhauled its bus network. There have been tweaks here and there, but nothing this big. So, SEPTA hired a consultant, Jarrett Walker, to come up with a framework for rethinking all of their bus routes. Walker sounds more like a philosopher than a planner.
We're all imprisoned to relative degrees, where the walls of our prison are the limits of where we could get to in a reasonable amount of time. When we expand where people can get to in a particular amount of time, that's not only access to jobs and opportunity, but in a more fundamental sense, it's expanding people's freedom.
SEPTA will consider dozens of changes to how its buses run. Long routes may be shortened, loopy lines may be straightened. The old transfer fees might end, and new bus-only lanes might begin. Everything is on the table. But a complete rethink of when and where SEPTA's buses run doesn't mean everything is going to change.
Inevitably, you end up putting back something that looks 70 to 90% like the existing network. But the goal is not that. The goal is to draw a new network from today's needs only, so that you know when you're done that your network is not about history, it's about the present.
Philly's bus systems will be stuck in the past for a little bit longer. Once SEPTA hires a consulting team this winter, the redesign will take 2 to 3 years of planning and then even more time to execute. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Right now, the Mercer Museum in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, has an exhibition on the history of racing, foot racing, bicycle racing, horse racing, and motorsports. Bucks County was once a hotbed of car racing, with several speedways and drag strips for hot rodders in the 1950s and 60s. One of those gearheads who used to soup up old cars blazed a trail for African-American racers. Leonard Miller has spent 50 years overcoming racial and class roadblocks to develop black race drivers in the predominantly white sport. Miller's 2004 autobiography, Silent Thunder, is now being developed into a documentary film. WHYY's Peter Crimmins spoke to him.
You grew up on the main line, I understand, and you were kind of a car-crazy kid back in the 50s, souping up hot rods.
Yes, I got started at 5 years old, 1939. My mother worked for the Hill Estate in Wayne, Pennsylvania. The rich blue bloods of the area were in two things, horse racing and race cars. I took to the race car side of it. I learned through osmosis just how wonderful the world was. For example, when they have Memorial Day parade, this is before World War II, you see all these Stutz Bearcats, old Cords, Duesenbergs, great magnificent cars. And that, I was just taken in by it.
What was your first car?
My first car was a 1940 Ford Club Coupe convertible, highly modified, chop top, Mercury motor, Lincoln transmission, and I kept it going through Bill Jones's junkyard. Bill Jones had a junkyard on Route 30 coming out of Paoli, Pennsylvania. He was a big African-American number writer and a gambler, and he had this junkyard as a front. He went to Eastern State Penitentiary, and he served 2 years. And when he came out, no one in the black community would speak to him. Don't talk to him. So my father always told me, speak to everybody and treat everybody right. So I spoke to him, and my father always spoke to him. Everyone else ostracized him. I would come down from the college, and I would get parts. He always said, you spoke to me, young man, and your dad always treated me right. So he gave me free things out of the junkyard. But all those little things that you wouldn't think helped me along the way.
You talk a lot about the little things in the book, in Silent Thunder, like Bill, that you would get some pieces from the junkyard, you would get some guys from the gas station to help you out. It was a real, 1,000 hands touched you, got you racing.
Yes, it was 1,000 hands, and it's still, even now, the last time we raced and won was in NASCAR, and that was 2007. It's people helping it.
You came up through racing through these scrappy, I guess like a scrappy beginnings, and eventually you work your way up to a national level. You're competing in NASCAR. How does one break into NASCAR? How did you break into NASCAR?
We broke into NASCAR with a small sponsorship from General Motors. We found a driver, Chris Woods, in Boylston, Massachusetts, and took him down south. And we started him in the late model series, and that's how we started in NASCAR. And the reason we had to go to NASCAR in 1979 became the series that the television people liked. It became the series that America gravitated to. First of all, it's closed circuit racing, so you can put cameras all the way around the track. There are personalities of the drivers fighting all the time and that type of thing. And so NASCAR took off. So we had to switch over to NASCAR because there's no money in sponsorship in the open wheel. You had to do it. Only reason.
You've talked about getting money from corporations, approaching them for sponsorships, and how it's very difficult because of the way large corporations dole out sponsorship money. I mean, the way you have described in the past, these corporations have buckets of money that they like to give out. There's the football bucket. There's the NASCAR bucket. There's the music and concert bucket. And then there's the black bucket. And when you approach them to run NASCAR, they pull it out of the black bucket.
Yes. It's very hard for an American corporation to write a check for $1 million to an African American race team. It's very hard. There's a black bucket, and everything black goes in that bucket. Mm-hmm. What it is to keep the civil rights leaders quiet. So if you give the civil rights leaders, say, then they won't march on at headquarters, like Ford Motor Company did 2 weeks ago down at the Martin Luther King assassination celebration, not celebration, but, you know, in Tennessee, Ford Motor Company gets $50,000. So that's their contribution to the black community.
And since they gave $50,000 to the MLK anniversary, they're not going to give it to a black driver.
No.
Because they've already used up their black quota.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm speaking with Leonard Miller. He's owner of Race Car Teams and the author of Silent Thunder, which will soon be a documentary film in the next couple of weeks. Thanks so much for talking.
Leonard Miller will appear at the Mercer Museum in Doylestown this weekend, along with the original founders of the Black American Racers Association, for a panel discussion about black auto racing. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.